My name is Ray Choate. I'm the University Librarian here at the Barr Smith Library at the University of Adelaide, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you here this evening. And I see a lot of faces that I've not seen here before, and we're very pleased to see new people at these functions. The first thing I have to remind you is if you have one of these gadgets, and when I can get mine out, called a mobile phone or a cell phone or whatever you want to call it, please make sure it's switched to the off mode. There's nothing more disturbing to a speaker than to have mobile phones go off. So while you're doing that, I will ask Oliver Mayo, who's president of the Friends of the Library, to continue the function.
Thank you, Ray. Before introducing Gilad, I should just acknowledge the Kaurna people, the long-term custodians of the land on which the University of Adelaide and many other things are built, and feel grateful for their custodianship. It's a great pleasure to introduce Gilad Zuckerman. Indeed, it's a great thing that we have him here in the University of Adelaide. He is Professor of Linguistics of Endangered Languages, and he's also an Australian Research Council Discovery Fellow here. Just reading a list of his achievements and where he's worked and what he's done makes me feel tired. But he's a young and highly active man, and even though he just got in on the red-eye special from China and his wife is about to give birth to their third son, I'm sure that he's full of energy for this evening. One of his major books is, in English, Israeli, A Beautiful Language. Out there you can order his next book, and he has written a number of other books. But he's an expert of revival linguistics, which of course Israeli Hebrew is a triumphant success at any level. He's written sensitively about the differences in trying to revive Australian Aboriginal languages that are dying out as we speak. I was talking to some linguists in Canberra a week ago tonight, and they were saying that I think there are 16 speakers of one particular language, and one had just died the previous week. I mean, that's how bad it is with Australian languages. And most Australian citizens are indifferent to their plight. Anyway, Gilad has worked recently in China, as I said, but he's also been a research fellow at Churchill College, Cambridge. He's taught at Cambridge, he's worked at Oxford, he's worked in Queensland, Singapore. He's been fortunate to be worker, if that's the right word, at the Villa Serbelloni in Italy and many other places. We're very lucky to have him here in Adelaide to work, as he will no doubt, successfully on language revival. And we're also lucky to have him here tonight because mostly his emails end with something like salutations from Ouagadougou or hail from Ulaanbaatar. But anyway, here he is tonight. And we have another departure from the normal format, and Gilad is going to introduce the musician.
Thank you so much, Oliver Mayo, for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here. And also to you, Ray Choate, for the welcome. I would like to start with Siobhan Owen, who is a Celtic harpist and singer. And I asked her to perform two Welsh songs just to let us know that, in fact, the situation, the grave situation of language dying is not just an Aboriginal problem, but it's a worldwide problem. So we will start with one song in Welsh and another one in Welsh. And Siobhan has kindly agreed to introduce the songs briefly. Thank you, Siobhan.
Hi, I'm going to sing a piece called Lí Sallán. It's about a man who's grieving for his lost love. It's actually from the island of Anglesey, which is where I was born, in a very small town called Llanfairpwllgwyngyllgogerychwyndrobwyllantysiliogogogoch.
Thank you so much, Siobhan Owen. Siobhan will play yet another Welsh song at the end of my presentation, so I hope you will stay. I have three main questions that I would like to ask today. Why on earth should we invest time and money in reviving languages? That's the first question I would like to ask. And there will be three answers: ethical, aesthetic, and utilitarian reasons. The second question I'm going to ask today, is it really possible to reclaim a no longer spoken language? And here I will show you Stephen Fry interviewing myself on the Hebrew Revival, so it will be a short video. And the third question is, how can we help Aboriginal and other endangered heritage people to reclaim their languages? And this is when I will talk about establishing revival linguistics. So let me start with, why on earth should we invest time and money in reviving languages? In other words, why should we care about dead languages? Because many people say, well, the world will have less wars if we speak only one language, etc. As I said, ethical reasons, aesthetic motivations, and utilitarian benefits. The first thing is ethical, historical, humanistic, and social justice, as it is. For me, this is enough, but not for the public servant, of course. If you talk to a man in a language he understands, that goes to his head. If you talk to him in his language, that goes to his heart. This is Nelson Mandela. Native tongue title. I believe that we should compensate Aboriginal people in Australia for the loss of the language, because the loss of language is more severe than the loss of land. Why is it that the loss of language is more severe than the loss of land? The reason is simple, as I myself see it. When you lose your land, the land is still there. When you lose your language, there is nothing there. The land might be abused by other people, but when you lose your language, you lose your cultural autonomy, you lose your spiritual and intellectual sovereignty, because a language is a repository of ideas, values, and experience. Russell Hoban, who was a children's writer, said, language is an archaeological vehicle full of the remnants of dead and living pasts, lost and buried civilizations and technologies. The language we speak is a whole palimpsest of human effort and history. And I wrote it as a palimpsest. You know, a palimpsest is something that you write on top of another. Other ethical reasons, in the case of linguicide or language killing or glottophagy, this is language eating, so the difference is very simple. When the colonizers come and, for example, take Aboriginal people out of their homes, this is killing the language, this is linguicide, just like genocide, suicide, etc. But when Aboriginal people decide, well, we don't want to speak our language because we want our children to be integrated, assimilated, etc., that's more glottophagy. And glottophagy happens even within Aboriginal languages. So Pidgin Jajara is glottophagizing Yankun Jajara, for example. So it is a phenomenon which is less cruel as linguicide. Now, in case of linguicide or glottophagy, it is much harder to prove continuity in native title cases. As you know, native title, since Mabo, etc., you try to prove continuity, but when you don't have your language, you don't have continuity. So my idea is that, in fact, if you lose your native title case, you should apply then for native tongue title case. In other words, you should be compensated for the loss of your language. A language should have a price. You lose your language, you get $10 million for the revival of language. Protection of intellectual property, IP, traditional indigenous knowledge, language, stories, music, dance, symbols, art, crafts, cosmology, medicinal and environmental knowledge, etc. So these are ethical reasons. I should just say that, as you all know, out of 250 Aboriginal languages that we are aware of, only 15 to 20 are alive and kicking, meaning they have speakers of all age groups. In other words, most Aboriginal languages are either dead, in quotation marks, sleeping beauties, or about to die. And I take here the Australian flag designed by Harold Thomas and first flown just not far from here, 1971, the year I was born. And you see the black, which is the people, the red, which is the land, and then you see the sun, which is life. I would, with the permission of Harold Thomas, I would like to change it a little bit. So you see the black, which is the lads, lasses, the red, which is the land, and then the lang, the language, which is pink. And the reason is that the tongue is the mouth of the land, so, and it reflects this flag, the trinity of earth, people, and language. But there are also aesthetic motivations for why we should reclaim languages. When you lose a language, you lose a culture, intellectual wealth, a work of art. It's like dropping a bomb on a museum, the Louvre. This was said by Ken Hale in The Economist on the 3rd of November, 2001. He was a very famous American linguist who did a lot of work in Australia. If I went to the, I mean, not under the current situation when I've just come back from China with some intestine suffering, but if I go to the Adelaide market and they only offer me cheddar cheese, I would be very upset because I go there and I buy many types of cheeses, and this is beautiful to have this diversity. The same with language. If you look at rich, colorful Australia, the lucky country, with 250 languages. Of course, there are many disputes. Is this Bangla or is it another language, etc.? Look at this, how beautiful it is. And look how ugly this one is. Monolingual mindset Australia, unlucky country. Just one language, Australian English or Aussie English, which is a beautiful language, of course, but it's just, this is what we do not want. We do not want Homo sapiens sapiens to go into kind of a robotic uniformity stage. This is what we do want. This is at the United World College of the Adriatic in 1987. And you have Karen Mok, who is a very famous singer and actress in the Sinosphere, with your humble servant and some other people from many different countries. The most complex Chinese character I have ever encountered, pronounced biang, biang, and it refers to specific noodles. I just saw it 5 days ago. This is beautiful to have this character. And of course, this is part of the Chinese heritage, but the character itself is endangered, although the Chinese is not endangered. Diversity. Here we should talk a little bit about Kuuk Tayore. And Boroditsky and Gabi in 2010 had a wonderful experiment. They went to America, they went to Israel, and they went to Cape York Peninsula. You know Cape York Peninsula in the northern part of Australia. And what they did was very fascinating. They asked people to put cards in order. So they showed four cards. For example, a person fanning a banana on one card, a person peeling the banana on another card, a person eating the banana on the third card, and on the fourth card, a person throwing away the peels. And they asked these people, the Israeli speakers or the Hebrew speakers, the revived Hebrew speakers, the American English speakers, and the Kuuk Tayore speakers to put them in order. What do you think happened? Fascinating. The Israelis put the cards from right to left. The reason being that the Hebrew writing is from right to left because right-handed people, when they wrote in the past on the stone, they of course wrote this way. The Americans put the cards from left to right, and the reason is that with ink, it's much better to write from left to right. This is a modern development. What happened in Kuuk Tayore? They always put the cards, top down sometimes, sometimes bottom up, sometimes left right, sometimes right left. They always put the cards from east to west. Always from east to west. This was a subconscious decision. They were unaware of this, but it happened automatically, just like that English people or American people did it subconsciously from left to right. This is a beautiful diversity, and the reason is that in that Aboriginal language, you do not have left and right. So if I want to say you X sits north of Y, I do not say X sits left of Y. The result is a linguistic GPS. And by the way, if you bring an Aboriginal person from there here, I'm sure he or she is more likely to know where the north is as opposed to people who, I guess in Adelaide it's easy to know where the north, but diversity is very understood when it comes to animals. People love diversity. This is from the Adelaide Zoo. The survival of the Tasmanian devil is important. What about the survival of the Palawa languages of Tasmania? Why is it that nobody gives money to Palawa languages, but people do donate money to animals? and I'm one of them. So we exist to save animals from extinction, but we exist to save languages and cultures from extinction. What's the difference? Why pandas are more, why is it that people are more attached to pandas than to languages? Why is it that people do not care that out of 7,000 languages, within 100 years, we'll end up with anything between 700 and 3,000 languages? So up to 90% of languages will disappear. Diversity, endangered grammatical ways to express familiar concepts. Now, this is for you, Siobhan, because in Welsh, as you beautifully pronounce, there is this chl, as in Pink Floyd, you know, Pink Floyd. Used to be Pink Floyd with a double L, Lloyd, yeah, Cloyd. Here in this language, Yagan, Tierra del Fuego, Chile in Argentina, there is a word, mami chlapinatapai. It's the same chl, mami chlapinatapai, just like in Welsh. And mami chlapinatapai means to look one at the other, hoping that the other side would do something that both sides have been longing to do, have been very much wanting to do, but so far, no one has ever had the guts to do that. Now, this concept exists, I guess, in Anglo contexts. I had this feeling in the past without speaking Yagan, without knowing this mami chlapinatapai. But we will lose, the moment we lose Yagan, the grammatical way of having one word, which means this concept, which in English I need, I guess, 26 words to express. And this is just an example of a morphological analysis. Ma is a reflexive passive prefix. You don't need to know that, but it has an allomorph, mam. And then itlapi is to be at a loss as what to do next. This is the root, the lexical morpheme. Then you have the stative suffix, the achievement suffix, and the dual suffix, which in composition with ma has a reciprocal sense, etc. So we linguists learn how this concept, which we are aware of anyway, is grammaticalized. Diversity also has this endangered concept. So sometimes when we lose languages, we lose concepts that we will never be able otherwise to come up with. So Nahur, for example, in Persian, this is old Persian. If you ask a Farsi speaker, he or she will probably not know of this word. It's a camel that will not give milk until her nostrils have been tickled. Now, if this specific word dies, that's it. I mean, unless we have such good imagination. But humans usually do not have such a good imagination. Look at aliens in Hollywood movies. They all look like human beings. Two eyes, one, I mean, it's ridiculous. Endangered concepts as well. Tingo, the language is Pasquan in Eastern Polynesian. It's an Eastern Polynesian language in the Easter Island. It means to take all the objects one desires from the house of a friend, one at a time, by asking to borrow them until there is nothing left. Now, this concept I have ever thought of without knowing Pasquan. So this is an endangered concept. When we lose languages, we actually lose concepts. Now, this is not something to be kind of frivolous about. Now, so far I've discussed ethical reasons and aesthetic reasons. But now I would like to discuss utilitarian benefits. And when I say utilitarian, I mean benefits that the public servant will say, ah, okay, so far I don't care about Aboriginal people, I don't care about, but utilitarian benefits I care about. Closing the gap, you know, all these kind of big words that politicians like hearing. So here we go. Personal, mental, and physical well-being. Well-being is a very important part of language revival. Sense of pride and self-esteem, antidote for self-loathing. I will give you an email from Jenna on the 3rd of May, 2012. This is verbatim, this is copied. Personally, I found the experience of learning our language, this is Bangla, I gave a workshop in Bangla, liberating, and went home feeling very overwhelmed because we were finally going to learn our own language. It gave me a sense of identity, and I think if the whole family learned our language, then we would all feel totally different about ourselves and each other, because it's almost like it gives you a purpose in life. This is what she says unsolicitedly. A Facebook comment from Evelyn, 21st of April, so just less than a month ago. A big thank you on behalf of our family here in Port Lincoln. Our ancestors are happy. Our ancestors are happy is a very good sign. There are cognitive advantages of bilingualism. Here I would like to mention Kovac and Miller in 2009. Kovac and Miller took seven-month-old babies. Half of them were exposed to two languages, French and English, and half of them were exposed only to English. But these are pre-verbal babies, right? They do not speak, of course, at the age of 7 months. What happened was they showed these babies a screen with a flashing light on one side of the screen. Suddenly, there was a flashing light on the other side of the screen. What do you think happened? The bilingual children, or more specifically, the bilingually exposed children, noticed the light much faster than the monolingual children, which Kovach and Miller believe means that when you're bilingual, meaning you speak two languages as your mother tongues, this facilitates better cognition, better cognitive abilities, which are beyond language, because this is not a linguistic ability to notice a light on the other side of the screen. So there are many researchers that show that bilingualism, meaning a person talking two mother tongues, is very good for your cognition. The bilingual's enhanced experience with sound results in an auditory system that is highly efficient, flexible, and focused in its automatic sound processing, especially in challenging or novel listening conditions, says Nina Kraus in 2012. In other words, if you are bilingual, you are more likely to concentrate when there is noise around you. This is a new research. The medical advantage of bilingualism, anti-dementia. So bilingual people are less likely to get dementia when they're old. Utilitarian benefits, employability, obtaining jobs based on acquired literacy, numeracy, and computer skills, translation, interpreting, teaching, literature, etc. Why are there no poets in Bangla? Why are there no poets in other Aboriginal languages? Who said that only English should have poets in Australia? Now, for bean counters, as opposed to groundbreakers, I would say that reviving languages saves governmental money associated with ill health and social dysfunction. You can make the calculations how much it costs to have, for example, a psychiatric treatment for a year, etc. I'm not going to talk about jail and things like that. Educational empowerment. Aboriginal people involved in language reclamation acquire academic self-confidence, improving their accomplishments in other non-linguistic subjects. So you go to language revival, you become fluent in your language, then you become better in mathematics. We have evidence for that. This is why we close the gap. Cultural tourism, code talking, secret languages used for security purposes, you know, the Navajo in World War II, etc. This is a funny example. For groundbreakers, potential contribution to future scientific breakthroughs. And this is the realm of the unknown unknowns. You know that Donald Rumsfeld once said a sentence, "We know what we know we do not know, but we do not know what we do not know," and people ridicule this sentence. I thought the sentence was actually very clever, because the unknown unknowns are the most difficult ones. I cannot know what we will find in the future because of languages. Mathematics emerged from languages that had a counting system, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I don't know what will come up of Kuuk Taiori in the future, scientifically, I mean. So there is no way to know. So the moment you let it die, that's it. Medical discoveries based on rainforest plants that would have been extinct without sustainability and environmental conservation, etc. We have Professor Ron Luftig, my friend from America here, who can talk about it as well. Intellectual property generation two. Do you remember I mentioned the intellectual property of I believe that establishing revival linguistics will turn First Nations Australians into the world's experts of language revival, because in Australia we have a huge potential to become the world's leaders of language revival, because we have the most unlucky situation in the world when it comes to languages. So we need to turn it upside down. In the future, the very insights offered by revival linguistics will themselves become part of Aboriginal intellectual property. So this is intellectual property generation two. Slovenes, Estonians, hopefully not Welsh people, but you know there is a renewal in Wales, of course, will come to Australia to ask Indigenous Australians to assist them in their own European language resurrection. Now, this of course will happen unless we find a way to inject language into the brain. And I don't know, we might find in the future a way to inject language. So you go to Thailand, you get the traveler's diarrhea, and then you also get Thai, so you can speak with the local people. But until that happened, of course we need revival linguistics, and I don't think it will happen in the next 20 years. Now, I mentioned revival linguistics, so I would like at this stage, let's have a look at the time, to have a 7-minute video, or 8-minute, and this will be the entire thing when it comes to the Hebrew revival, and then I'm going to discuss revival linguistics. I think that Stephen Fry chose the 8 minutes out of the 7 hours of interviews, which kind of tells you in a kind of a beautiful way the hybridity of the Israeli language. So let me just have this now here, and then we'll continue to discuss.
It's hard enough to transform a language a word at a time. All the more extraordinary is to resurrect an entire language from the dead as an act of political will to gift an identity to a whole nation. Israel had a difficult birth, a tricky childhood, and a stormy adolescence. Whatever one's views of the current political situation here, it was a remarkable journey to statehood, and language was at the center of it. Hebrew was the language spoken here centuries before a man called Jesus Christ walked these streets. But after the diaspora, the dispersal of the Jews throughout Europe, and 2,000 years of persecution, Hebrew died out as a spoken language, remembered only in the Torah, in rabbinical tradition, and in Friday night suppers in Jewish homes. Fast forward to the creation of the State of Israel in the aftermath of the Second World War and the Holocaust. The most crucial question facing them was, what language do we speak? Yiddish, the lingua franca of the Middle European Jew, was polluted, tainted by the shtetl, by pogroms, and by the death camps. Russian was too limited, so they made the bold decision to reinvent Hebrew as a modern living language. Israeli linguist Gilad Zuckerman is taking me to Rishon LeZion, where the first Hebrew school was built in 1889. Stopping off in a garage for some mechanical problem solving exposes an intriguing linguistic problem. How do you describe things that simply didn't exist in the Bible?
Shalom.
Hi.
I'm Oren.
Oren.
Oren. Handbrakes. יש קרבורטור?
לא, אין כאן קרבורטור, היום זה כבר אינג'קטורים.
I got that. You said it's the carburetor and you said no, it's fuel injected.
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of English words in there.
Well, they did create Hebrew words for carburetors, etc., but not all of them caught on.
There are a lot of English words. Are there any biblical Hebrew words in there that you can see?
יש פה שמות עבריים.
Yes.
למשל, מה עברית?
Battery is
It's a Hebrew-based word.
Right.
But obviously it's a new word because it's a new concept.
Right, so it wouldn't exist in the Bible.
Right. It's bor means to collect and to store. So matzber, you know, it collects, I guess, energy.
Well, that's also known as a capacitor.
Capacitor.
So it's capacitor. Exactly. The same idea. And I mean, this bottle here, I mean, obviously there would be Hebrew words in the Bible for bottles and jars. The coolant inside, but the container, the receptacle.
Mechal, ibui. Right. Mechal actually is a Hebrew word, which means container.
Right, that's what I wanted. That you would find in the Bible. Women carrying pots and all kinds of, you know, my pot's heard, and lots of words like that in the Bible.
Yes.
Potter's vessel.
You'll see modernization of ancient terms.
Yes.
But usually when it comes to cars, the English words, for example, if you have a puncture, puncture.
Call it a puncture.
Teker. You see, he knows the Academy of the Hebrew language word neker or teker, but actually people say puncture. Many Jews.
So Hebrew has an academy as well. Not so surprising, I suppose, when they started a language from scratch. Car duly fixed, we're off now to visit the place where it all began.
מבינים כאילו שזה בלגן, אבל תוהו ובוהו זה לא בלגן. אתם שמעתם את הביטוי עלה בתוהו?
When Eliezer ben Yehuda, the prime force behind the revival of Hebrew, began to teach here, Palestine was still part of the Ottoman Empire, and his students would have been dressed as these children have today. The slow process of reinventing modern Hebrew had begun. Ironically, the Yiddish language, sturdy enough to survive the Holocaust, was facing a more serious threat from the State of Israel.
In this classroom, these were the young pioneers, or if you call them the early Zionists, which was not then necessarily a colored political word, it just meant they wanted to live here. They were being taught what kind of Hebrew? Because the Hebrew you speak, which you call Israeli, which seems a very sensible idea, presumably was not the same as the one they were being taught. It was being developed.
They were taught in the best Hebrew which was available for their teachers. Let us remember that the teachers were not Hebrew speakers.
It wasn't their first language.
It was not their first language. No. They were not native Hebrew speakers.
There were
they were
none.
Exactly. Yeah. They were mostly Yiddish speakers. Now,
yeah.
They could not, in fact, rid themselves from the structures of Yiddish.
But modern Israeli Hebrew has been an enormous success. It is a first language for most of the population of the country. And how is it that it managed, this engineered language managed to succeed?
I think that at the end of the day, there was a lot of ideology for and the wish to have a language for the future state. And the other thing was to have a language which was a unifying tongue for all the Jews, because Jews came from all over the world.
Right,
and this
speaking
was
different languages. So in a sense, it was political will and it was identity that,
right,
that drove it.
Definitely identity. But the important thing to realize is that the success of Israeli, of course, is not only the revival of Hebrew, but rather the survival of all the other languages, like Yiddish, etc. Israeli, if you want, is on the one hand a phoenix rising from the ashes,
yeah.
Hebrew. On the other hand, it's a cuckoo laying its eggs in the nest of another bird,
yeah.
Tricking it to believe that it is its own bird. This is Yiddish.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's a magpie stealing from American and Polish. So it's a phoenix-cuckoo hybrid bird with some magpie characteristics. And in fact, I would argue that Israeli is not Retzach Yiddish or the murder of Yiddish, but rather Yiddish Retzach. So Yiddish speaks itself within Israeli. And this is the irony of history.
Yeah.
Ben Yehuda and many other revivalists wanted very much to reject Yiddish, but history tells us, no, Yiddish survives beneath Israeli. So Israeli is a story of revival and survival.
Right. I suppose the only thing I would say is that if Yiddish had been chosen as the language for Israel, it would have been a funnier country. It just would have been funnier.
But
then
we...
Hey! Do schlep your bag for you, sir. You go to the hotel.
Yeah, so Finicuckoo hybrid, Finicuckoo cross with some characteristics of a magpie. If you have a better drawing, let me know. And this is Eliezer ben Yehuda on the left, the famous revivalist that Stephen Fry mentioned. And his son, his grandson, whose name is Eliezer ben Yehuda, is this one here. And we had a lovely interview together. And he loved very much my ideas about the hybridity of the of revived Hebrew. So as you heard, I believe that when you revive a language, you end up with a hybrid. As Jerry Seinfeld said, not that there is anything wrong with that. I love hybridity, but I believe that we ought to establish a new field within linguistics and within anthropology and within many other fields. I mean, revival linguistics is not only linguistics, it's many other things. It's spiritual ways of looking at the world, etc. And I'm here answering the third question that we have today. How can we help Aboriginal and other endangered heritage people to reclaim their languages? Because we hopefully agree by now that it is worthwhile to revive languages. And we agree by now that it is possible to revive language. My only mother tongue is a revived tongue. I'm a speaker of revived Hebrew. That's my only mother tongue. And if I speak coherently, it means that it is possible to revive a language. And revived linguistics exactly does that. It looks at insights that we can take from the revival of Hebrew, the revival of Hawaii, the revival of Ghana. We have here Dr. Rob Amory. We have many other people from language revival. We have Karina Lester here. Karina. We have Dr. Marianne Gale. We have independent scholars here, by the way. I'm very happy to see all the people here. Revival linguistics is a new field currently being established at Adelaide. With globalization, homogenization, and co-colonization, there will be more and more groups added to the forlorn club of lost heritage people, unfortunately. Language revival will therefore become increasingly relevant as people seek to recover their heritage and to improve their well-being. There is an urgent need to offer perspicacious insights relevant to language reclamation. This is a new field because there are not too many revival attempts so far, but this is an emerging endeavor. There are more and more revival attempts, so there is a need here. Revival linguistics analyzes comparatively and systematically the universal constraints and global mechanisms on the one hand, and the local peculiarities and idiosyncrasies on the other, apparent in revival attempts across various sociological backgrounds all over the globe. A branch of both linguistics and applied linguistics often deals with second language acquisition. It is a branch of both linguistics and applied linguistics because language reclamation is the most extreme case of second language learning. Think about it. When you learn Chinese, it's a difficult language with the characters and with the tones, but you can go to China and you can listen to millions of native speakers. When you learn Ghana, when you learn Bangla, when you learn Ngarinjeri, when you learn so many Aboriginal, you do not have the people to listen to. You do not have native speakers. So this is an extreme case of second language learning. It combines scientific studies of both native language acquisition and foreign language learning. Therefore, I hope to attract as many linguists as possible. It is closely related to contact linguistics, the analysis of cultural contact as manifested in language. It changes the field of historical linguistics, e.g. by weakening the family tree model, which implies that a language ought to have only one parent. As you saw with Stephen Fry, a revived language has more than one parent, and therefore this idea of one language, one parent is flawed. It complements the established field of documentary linguistics, which records endangered languages before they fall asleep. It revises the fields of grammaticography, writing grammars, and lexicography, writing dictionaries. It proposes that grammars and dictionaries ought to be written for language reclamation in a user-friendly way for communities, not only for linguists. This is a very important point that I would like to say today. We should avoid highfalutin, often Latin-based grammatical terminology. We should employ user-friendly spelling. So juxtapose claim of Wilhelm Schürmann's 1844 spelling of, well, how do you read this word, N-U-N-Y-A-R-A? How would you read it? Nanyara. Well, most Bangla people would say Nanyara. This is how they pronounce recovery. There is an organization called Nanyara. But in fact, it's Nunyara. The reason that Schürmann wrote it with a U was that he was a German Lutheran missionary, in which a U stands for U, just like in Italian. By the way, the IPA, the International Phonetic Alphabet, also has U as U. But the Aboriginal languages, the Aboriginal people of Wayala, Port Lincoln, and Port Augusta, for them, U is A, it's not U. And therefore, my proposed spelling is with double O, which is exactly what they want. They want a user-friendly spelling. So this is just an example. This is Port Lincoln, South Australia, and I told you that about the workshop, so, and this is another. Revival linguistics. For linguists, the first stage of any language revival must involve a long period of observation and careful listening while learning, mapping, and characterizing the specific indigenous or minority or culturally endangered community. Only then can one inspire and assist. So if there is a community that does not want to revive its language, then of course we have nothing to do. I mean, it's the decision of the Aboriginal people if they want to revive or not. The white fellow linguists can assist, but they're not the ones who decide. That said, there are linguistic constraints applicable to all revival attempts. Mastering them would help revivalists and Aboriginal leaders to work more efficiently. For example, to focus more on basic vocabulary, basic words, and verbal conjugations than on sounds and word order, because with sounds and word order, you do not have much chance. If you listen to an Israeli speaking revived Hebrew, he does not sound like the ancient Isaiah. My name, Gilad, there is a pharyngeal gulp, is not pronounced Gilad, it's pronounced Gilad, just like Julia Gillard. So Gilad, not Gilad, the only difference is the stress, Gilad. Right, it's not Gilad. There is no ayin, there is no kuf, there is no chet. The expectoration, if you expectorate as a Semite, you need to learn to expectorate. The sound which exists in Arabic was also apparent in Hebrew, but it is not apparent in Israeli or revived Hebrew. So we need to accept that revival cannot be perfect, but again, not that there is anything wrong with that. So revival linguistics is very realistic. Revival linguistics would help revivalists to be more realistic and abandon discouraging slogans such as give us authenticity or give us death. It assists indigenous communities in a realistic, non-puristic way without selling them myths. It discards any imprisoning purism prism. Shift happens. And if I say shift happens, I guess that I need to ask Robina how many minutes do I have left? Sorry? Minus one. Oh. So minus one means okay, no worries. So I'll give you an example of shift happening. Latin bulgarus, Bulgarian, enters French as bug, Bulgarian and heretic in the 11th century, and now we have English bugger. I have never heard of a Bulgarian who wrote a letter to the queen, please stop using the word bugger when referring to your husband, because it means Bulgarian. This is how shift happens, right? Bugger actually etymologically means Bulgarian, but no one actually knows about it anymore. So this is how shift happens. Shift happens, the native speaker is always right, fascinating organic evolution. In English, do you remember, there was thou, singular, ye, plural. Then because of simplification, we ended up with you for singular and plural. This was a simplification process. And now we have a wonderful, beautiful complexification process in which we have you for singular and yous or you guys or yoles for plural. That actually complexifies the language. And any person who tells a young person, don't say yous, you are destroying the language, etc. Actually, this language is more complex than the language of the adults. So this is how shift happening. I have many other examples that I could have given you. I'll give you some examples from classical Hawaiian. Ho'e ho'e, to paddle a canoe, versus hoi hoi, interesting fun, but in Neo-Hawaiian, 3,000 people, still non-native, both words are pronounced the same as hoi hoi, right? This is the sounds that I was talking about. Oh, that's a calking from the revivalist mother tongue, a beautiful example of reclaimed Ghana, yata piriti, and this is, there is a new spelling. It means cricket in the sport, but it comes from, of course, English cricket sport, but which is etymologically unrelated to the insect, and it comes from Ghana, the Ghana word for the insect. So this is a beautiful case of how the language the revivalists speak determines the way that the revived language will be. In American Yiddish, for example, if you want to say, I like her, you say, ich gleich. Gleich. Gleich in Yiddish means to like, to be fond of. But actually in Yiddish itself, in Yiddish from Eastern Europe, gleich only meant like as in similar to. But what happened, because in American, there are two likes, unrelated by the way, if you look at the Oxford English Dictionary, like to be fond of and like similar to have nothing to do with each other. But because of the phonetic similarity, just like cricket, in Yiddish you just say ich gleich im, etc., etc. So this is another example of calking from the mother's tongue. Now I'll show you some photos and then we'll end up with a beautiful song in Welsh. So this is Ghana woman, Dr. Alicia Rigney, 2011. And here Rob invited me to join all the Ghana people who were reclaiming the language on the 12th of April with Marianne. Here is Rob, second from left, with many Ghana people like Jack Buckskin and Louis O'Brien. This is the Turning Soul Ceremony, Gabmi Didi Manu, Bangala for Learning Together in Wayala, 8th of March, 2012. We will have a center there, a center for education. This is with Ngarindjeri people taking part in the revival of the Ngarindjeri language with Dr. Marianne Gale, who is here, Adelaide Mobile Language Team. Oh, this is Kunicha Brown from the Frigan community. She's an author of traditional music and contributor to the Center of Aboriginal Studies in Music, CASM. This is Paul Monahan with Gladys Miller, Mobile Language Team again. This is Bobby Brown, the Aboriginal guy, Wilkima, with Dr. Pitt, who could not be here, unfortunately. This is in New Zealand. It's not exactly reclamation, but endangered language. As you know, let Maori speak Maori. So in fact, I traveled with Karina, who is here there. This is Karina Lesser from the University of Adelaide Mobile Language Team. We have a wonderful mobile language team that will hopefully get funding for 3 more years. This is a parliamentary inquiry into language learning in Indigenous communities. It is headed by Shane Newman, who is an MP, and it was in the Adelaide Town Hall on the 2nd of April 2012. And what I told them was that, and I will finish within a second, 3 urgent needs at the University of Adelaide. We need a Centre of Research Excellence in Revival Linguistics, which will turn Adelaide into the world's mecca for language reclamation. You know that when I was in Bangala, in Port Lincoln, there was a woman, a Bangala woman, who saw some Muslims doing like that towards Mecca, but she didn't know what it was. She thought, and she went there and she asked, "How much money did you lose?" I mean, she was thinking that they were looking for the money. So this is a cross-cultural clash. Endangered Languages Fund, allowing independence of capricious federal policies. We never know what will be, what will happen next. Recently in Queensland, they cancelled the literary prize, so you never know. So we need to have an independence, and we will have an appeal for Endangered Languages Fund. And of course, we need generous scholarships for outstanding Indigenous people interested in studying linguistics. So the next professor of Endangered Languages will be an Aboriginal person. I think it is important to have Aboriginal people doing the language reclamation without depending on white fellows doing the "white fellows" bullshit. And this is a summary. If your language is endangered, do not allow it to fall asleep. If your language falls asleep, stop, revive, survive. If you revive a language, embrace the hybridity of the emerging tongue. And if your language is healthy, consider helping others in linguistic need. So thank you so much. I would like to ask Siobhan to play the final Welsh song, and then Oliver, after that I will let you, and maybe if we can have some time for questions.
This piece is it's about a dying harpist, and he's in bed, yes, and he calls out to his wife to bring him his harp so he can play it one last time before he dies. This is David the Garagwen, David of the White Rock.
Father.
Questions, just go ahead.
Yes, what's your name and please, yeah.
Penny, and I'd like to know, you know you were talking about...
That's a wonderful question. That's a wonderful question. Because although my name is not pronounced Gilad, when I write it both in Hebrew and in English, I write the ayin, the expectoration. So that's a very good question. It is a little bit like in English, when you write the word sign, you write S-I-G-N, because otherwise you would lose the link with signal. However, most languages in the world are not written languages. They're oral languages. And therefore, there is no reason whatsoever that we need to maintain the missionary's spelling that was, of course, linguistically not that advanced from the point of view of revival linguistics, right? So I keep my ayin because when you read the Hebrew Bible, there is Gilad there. But in the case of Aboriginal languages, when there is no writing, I believe that we should be as user-friendly as possible to the people who participate, who take part in the language revival. But this is a wonderful question. Yes, there was a question here. Yes. What's your name? Alistair. Yes.
You're already familiar with the Common European Framework. Do you think it's going to be successful?
So, the Common European Framework. No.
Very English.
No. Can you elaborate on it?
That they're going to, every individual in the European Union should speak at least two languages.
Right. As it happens, every European in Europe, except maybe the English, speak two languages in the sense that most friends that I know in Europe, they speak English, you know, but you know how English-Italian sounds like, right? It doesn't sound, sometimes it's not really English, but if you meant three languages, then yeah, that would be beautiful to have, for example, a German speaking German, English, and a third language that could be Ghana, could be Chinese, could be Gumbangir. I mean, it doesn't need to be a European language. It can be an Asian language. And the same when it comes to Australia. I mean, why is it that so many languages, LOTE, you know, L-O-T-E, languages other than English, sorry, they're usually European or Asian languages, and mostly they're not Aboriginal languages, and I wonder why. So yeah, it is of course possible to be bilingual, trilingual, multilingual, not in the mother tongue level, so you can have only one mother tongue, and then you can speak 22 languages. Yes. What? Yes. Alistair.
You talk about bilingualism as being anti-dimensional.
Yes.
I want to ask, are they now teaching in some schools from the mother tongue?
Right. Now, I think that when they talk about bilingualism as anti-dementia, they talk about bilingualism at the mother tongue level. In other words, if you are a bilingual in the sense that you speak two mother tongues, meaning you speak two languages perfectly, in quotation marks, in other words, when you go, let's say my children are trilingual, so when they go to China, they sound Chinese. When they go to Israel, they sound Israeli. When they are in Australia, they sound Australian. This is trilingualism, right? So we are not talking about bilingualism as, you know, acquiring a new a foreign language. We are talking about bilingualism as native bilingualism. However, there are researchers that also show that when you acquire another language as an adult, meaning after the age of 12, you also improve many things in your brain. But this is not as much as improving when you're a child. I should mention the critical period hypothesis in linguistics that says that just like ducks that can acquire the swimming ability within 36 hours, so if you take a duck who is born and you put the duck away from the pond and then you put the duck after 36 hours in the pond, it will die immediately. You know that. There is a critical period hypothesis. This is with ducks proved. The same with language. Well, this is what Chomsky says and others, in the sense that if you do not acquire a language before puberty, then you're not a native speaker. I mean, the chances that you will become a native speaker are very slim. So if you acquire a language after the age of 12, then you will not be a native speaker of course you should do that. It's beautiful. I have done it many, many times in many, many languages. But it's a different issue. Now, there was a question there. What's your name?
Just one more question with one short answer, I'm afraid, because of the time.
Okay, I will stay here. I'll stay here. Yes. Sorry, one and one. Yeah. Thank you so much for this comment. I have instructions here to take it as a comment. Yes, and yeah.
How to arrest the Northern Territory, who's prohibiting and pulling the rug out of native speakers who are in the schools as support teachers? The sadness that is throughout that state. Mm. How can the academics somehow engage with the education department and make this
Right, right. I think that there is a lot to improve in the Northern Territory. As you know, in the Northern Territory, there was bilingual program, bilingualism, until 98, and then it was discarded, and then the four hours at the beginning of the day were conducted in English, and all the rest was conducted in language. But then, of course, people come for 4 hours, and then they do not come back to schools. The attendance rates are very low, etc., etc. So you're right. There were some good intentions, sometimes out of ignorance, that is resulting in death of languages, and therefore linguists should be the ones who decide policies. Linguistic policies. So really, there should be kind of a linguistic committee that will decide, and not, you know, because of course when the government looks at the NAPALM, you know, all these exams, etc., they see that the scores are very low. Of course they're low, because the attendance rate is 10% or something like that. And of course, I mean, there are many reasons why they're low that have nothing to do with the bilingual system. In other words, I believe that an Aboriginal person who reaches CALP, CALP is an academic proficiency in, it's not academic in the sense of studying physics at the university, but CALP is kind of, it's more than just communicative thing, give me water, etc., but also a higher level of communication in language, will be much better equipped to get CALP in English. We see it everywhere. In Israel, when you have Amharic speakers who are illiterate, they try to teach them Hebrew writing, but actually this is a mistake. They should have taught them first literacy in their own language and only then literacy in Hebrew. But this is time-consuming. This is against the ideology. So, I mean, we have all these problems as well. It's a worldwide problem. But it's a very good point. There is definitely a need to change everything that happens in the Northern Territory. It's very dangerous. Yes. Last question, Rabbi Engel.
Ancient Jewish tradition that when biblical Joseph went before Pharaoh, Pharaoh had 70 languages that he knew, all the languages of the day. And in order to get up to Pharaoh, you had to actually know those languages, or you had to actually send a messenger up. Joseph was able to know all the, in other words, the wisest of all men was the one that knew all the languages. How does that fit with what you said today, that language has wisdom? And I would say it supports it, but is that an idea that was always there? That language is that? If you knew the language, you knew the culture, you know everything else about it?
I think that what you're saying fits very well, and as it happens, many things that are written in, if you look at the Tower of Babel, I mean the story of the Tower of Babel, whoever wrote it is a very indicative, a very telling story when it comes to language, because at the time, there is no doubt in my mind that we had maybe up to five centers where language evolved. This happened 70,000 years ago, etc., maybe before the immigration from Africa to Australia. So we know that there have been Aboriginal people in Australia at least for 51,000 years. At least 51,000 years. So it might well be the case that the Tower of Babel does depict reality, and it does well be the case that what you're saying about the person who speaks 70 languages actually means that he knows or the entire cultural autonomy, the entire intellectual sovereignty, spiritual sovereignty, etc. There is no doubt about that. I will just end by telling you that a friend of mine who is an Arabic scholar gave a lecture in Qatar, and he said in the lecture that the Quran has many words from Greek, Hebrew, Aramaic, and there were several people who got very upset. They kind of, you know, and they said, what are you talking about? The Quran is written in pure Arabic, you know. And my friend did not know how to get out of the quagmire. So what he said was very clever. He said, are you telling me that Allah does not know Aramaic? Are you telling me that Allah does not know Greek, etc.? So I think that this is in line with your question, that at the end of the day, it is not, and this is, by the way, how one should champion hybridity and cross-fertilization and cross-cultural communication within the same language. There is nothing wrong with hybridity.
I'd probably like to say, in just in conclusion, that the cultures will die along. Like, the powerful argument is that the cultures die along with the language, and that's something that means so much.
One thing for sure, the moment we are all the same, meaning there will be homogenization, there will be no Judaism. The moment mankind is homogeneous, this will be the end of Judaism. Well, that's my own kind of little prediction. But so you should fight for language revival, you should fight for diversity, you should fight for heterogeneity rather than homogenization. Thank you, Oliver.